This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidai is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Lea Davidai, who passed away earlier this year. Here I Am with Savta Lea in mind. We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
This episode of Here I Am with Shai Davidai is sponsored in part by Iron Dome Coffee. Iron Dome Coffee gives back 18% of every purchase to organizations helping Israeli society. Visit irondomecoffee.com and use the code Here I Am for an exclusive discount just for our listeners.
And the day after, we went outside and we saw thousands of posters all over the city that we never put up. By the end of the next day, we got photos of posters from all over the world.
My guest for today, this is a special treat. I typically see them when we're over for Shabbat dinner at our place. They are Israeli street and gallery artists. They are now based in New York City. They're also a couple, and they have some incredible stories. So here I am with Nitzan Mintz and Dede Bendid.
Hello, Shai.
Great to be here. Thank you for having us.
And I have to say, it's very weird for us to speak in Hebrew. So before the cameras started rolling, in English. Sorry, it was all in Hebrew, but we'll do it in English.
We'll do our best.
For people that are watching this rather than listening in, they might have some questions about Dede. Why is your face covered?
Explain. It's always better to do it like in two sentences in the beginning and forget about it. And I try to keep my identity as a secret, just to take it out of the equation, you know, to have people see my art, meet my art first, especially on the street. When they just walk in the street, they see usually my art. They don't know the person behind it, and they can relate with their own story, with their own point of view, without the person.
All right.
So separating that.
I think it was a few weeks ago, I made the mistake of saying, oh, Dede, you're like the Israeli Jewish Banksy. Mm-hmm. And Nitzan got angry.
Yeah, protective.
What can I say? He's not really pro-Israeli these days. Not that he was ever, but he became really radical. But
also because Dede is way better.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dede is better looking.
Nitzan, how do you deal with the anonymity that Dede... Because you are... The opposite of trying to stay anonymous,
yes.
Right?
When I started writing my poetry as graffiti when I was 17, I was the first one in Israel to write my full name in the streets as an illegal act. People used fake names. They invent characters for themselves. And I always, from the beginning, wrote Nitzan Mintz, like most of the poets would if it was in the book. But for me, I really appreciate Dede's anonymity. If I could go back in time, I might have done the same, because it gives you so much freedom, an artistic freedom, and it creates like a veil between your personal life and the audience. In my case, everything is personal. People can know everything about me, my family, my heritage, my history. With him, it's exactly the opposite.
And it works. Yeah. That mixture works together. So Dede, I think, obviously, the question that a lot of people have, and again, we have to get it out of the way, Dede Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Why the Band-Aid? And maybe for people that are listening, I need to describe, your mask is a cover full of your art, which is Band-Aid. You have wearing a hat of a Band-Aid sign as a heart. Your t-shirt has the Band-Aid. And your Reebok shoes are filled with Band-Aids.
Yeah, so I didn't start wearing all these band-aids since day one. I started painting the band-aids first after my military service as a result of PTSD. I finished my obligatory army service in Israel after 4 years. I was an officer. I served in Bethlehem and finishing...
When was this?
It was after the Second Intifada. A very rough time, especially around this area. You know, we had to wear this special vest, going in special vehicles, protected, being alert 24/7, sometimes have to go out of the vehicle, react to different situations. And I got this tension built over time and finished with PTSD. When I got back to, you know, like ordinary life, being citizen back again, there's not any program guiding you how to become this normal person again. And I usually say the band-aid found me, you know. I just started painting them in my notebook. It came as a vision. And the same night it came out of my hand, the same night I went outside in the streets of Tel Aviv, I started painting them obsessively everywhere. And it was like that night after night for months. And I still painting them. But back then, every night, crossing the city, north to south, east to west, and there was no one street I spared. And slowly people noticed and recognized. And even though I never signed the name Dede next to a band-aid, for me it was kind of a signature, and for me it wasn't that important if people know exactly who is doing it. I know they couldn't tell that the band-aid is coming from a specific trauma, you know. It's just a symbol, but they saw the band-aids and they relate from their point of view with their story, and many people started writing me, emailing me, commenting, finding me, you know, on Facebook, telling their very personal stories. And I found that the band-aid really helped more and more people. It helped me a lot. And after many years, I mean, I'm painting them for 15 years now, I can say that I'm cured from my PTSD. I don't feel it anymore, besides maybe October, but I'm sure we'll get to that. I don't feel my PTSD anymore, but I continue painting them in different projects with different meanings because of all these stories that I got along the way.
So what is the band-aid? What was the band-aid for you the first time you drew it?
Yeah.
And what is the band-aid now?
Exactly. So exactly like you said, along the way, it got more and many more meanings. So in the beginning, it was just a sign, you know, a way to communicate with passersby on the street, telling them that something is wrong. I myself didn't know exactly what I had. I just felt like super overwhelmed. I didn't know to say what is PTSD even. I didn't know what I have. I just wanted to put something out there. And once it's out there and I know people see it, it already helped me a lot. And after a long time of painting them, changing the composition, the shape a little bit, the size, enlarging them, you know, going from very small ones to like a whole facade, I got to know that a band-aid is a cover, that it tries to heal, but, you know, it's only hiding the problem sometimes. It's a very Israeli solution. It's a very poppy solution. It's a very simple solution, and sometimes it's not a solution at all. So it got many more meanings, and it already also changed the meanings depending on the place that it's placed. In the very early beginnings, I used to paint them on electricity boxes and utility boxes in the city because it had this crack in the center and I wanted to close this crack. But You know, I didn't think about it, but people wrote me and told me, oh, it's because the electricity is so expensive. So you paint it on electricity boxes and you're so smart. I didn't think about it. Later on, I started painting them on buildings, on walls, and people wrote me, oh, it's because the rent is so high. You know, it's expensive in Tel Aviv. You're so smart. I never thought about it. I just wanted to put my own message. But slowly I got that it got many, many stories, and we all share the same problems, and we all see these wounds that we want to heal.
Do you remember the first time you saw Dede's Band-Aids?
For sure. Again, I was a teenager back then. We're talking about 15 years ago. People in Tel Aviv called him the crazy Band-Aid guy. They had no face, they had no name, so they had to invent something. Crazy Band-Aid guy, because it was so obsessive. I was a groupie. I'm proud to say I was a groupie because he was very creative. He was creating images in the top floors of skyscrapers. Like, he was reaching every object in the public sphere and covering it with art. It was like observing the abilities of Superman as an artist. And I admired that as a creator, as a young girl who really wanted to do those kind of things herself with my poetry. And I started writing my poetry physically next to his artworks in the streets, because I thought to myself, maybe if I'll get closer to his art, he will get closer to me. Maybe this is the way to get his attention. And I used to do that for 2 years. It did not work. He did not he did not take any interest in my existence. He was very busy being himself. And I just tried and tried and tried. And then I wrote to him on Facebook and we became pen pals. And for 2 more years, I just wrote to this anonymous creature without knowing any biographical detail about him. It could have been, I don't know, just a weirdo.
Well, he is a weirdo, but a good weirdo.
Yeah, he is a weirdo. And we became soulmates, like really pen pals, like people who spoke from their soul.
So you also met Dede as an anonymous creator.
Yes, and even after all this time, those 4 years of me trying to get to him, when we finally met, he would not tell me his real name. Even after we kissed, even 2 weeks after we dated.
You never asked.
Come on, Dede. He never told me. He wanted to trust me. And it took him a while to tell me the boring biographical details, which are so unrelevant, you know?
It's interesting you say that, because I now realize that I don't know your... I don't want to call it real last name, because Band-Aid is your real last name, but your original last name.
So, yeah, I think Dede became like more original than anything people used to call me before. And actually, the nickname Dede started at home. It began when I was very, very young, and my parents invented it. And actually, many more people in Israel called Dede as a nickname. But the name Band-Aid, so people gave it to me on the street after seeing so many Band-Aids. And for me, it was really easy and kind of organic to just take the, I mean, you know, band, I mean, there's different ways to say Band-Aid. It can be a bandage or in different plaster, you know, in Hebrew or other languages. But growing up and always keeping an eye on American cartoons and advertising, like specifically choose the Band-Aid, was very organic for me.
Do you remember the first time you saw Nitzan's poems.
Oh, definitely.
Next to your Band-Aid.
So not next to my Band-Aid. I noticed her walk because she was super special and unique in the street. I was crossing Neve Tzedek neighborhood, South Tel Aviv, a lot. It's one of my favorite neighborhoods in the city to walk till this day. And that was like a weird phenomenon in the street. She used to make assemblage, like 3D collages from different kind of broken furnitures and everything she could find in their garage, in their home. And she built this, you know, very weird collages of, let's say, chair with rollerblades and a piece of brush. And on top, she wrote her poetry. And then she took all like this object, very weird and colorful installation, and she used to install it on tall lampposts, like wooden lampposts, and you couldn't not wonder, like, how did she reach this? like it's high, you know.
And I'm very short.
You're very short.
I didn't even know that back then, but you know, even if you take a ladder, it's high, and then you have to, you know, nail it to the pole, and you didn't see anything like that in the street. Like when we started painting or creating in the street in Israel, I wouldn't say we were the only ones, but it was kind of unique, like special in the street. Not many people did that. In Israel, you know, we adopt, especially in culture, we adopt what we see abroad. What we see in the US or in Europe that are much more progressive. And of course, in US, the graffiti or street art scene started much earlier. But in Israel, you didn't see this kind of stuff. You saw maybe tagging and spray paintings around the street, but nothing like that. So I noticed it like right away. And even when she signed her full name, you know, in Israel, you don't know if Nitzan is a boy or a girl. For me, she was also kind of anonymous, although she wrote her real name.
Oh, until, come on, you saw my face, okay, my Facebook account.
Okay, that came later.
All right.
That came later when you enter a Facebook account. Of course, you can see everything. But
and I was blonde back then.
Okay, really?
Yes, I was.
I can't imagine.
Yeah,
that.
She tricked me.
When did you start creating together?
Okay, so 4 years of me trying to get to him. And then it took us 2 more years to understand that the pieces laying around the floor belongs to each other. So we started sharing a space. And when you share space, Dede's pieces are laying here on the floor and my pieces are laying here on the floor. And then you have the chance to look at them and to say, what if we took them and we would make them as one? Text, like visual poetry with imagery. Why wouldn't it work together? The content by its own is dealing with the same issues. Dede and I speak different visual languages, and I deal with poetry. It's another world, but the inspirations and the traumas, they all speak about the same things. So the moment we understood that, we started attaching and trying to become as one as much as possible.
What is that trauma?
My trauma? Excuse me. Okay, so my trauma is coming from my childhood home. I grew up in a wonderful home with a wonderful family. I have the best family in the world. They're pretty unique people, two individuals that are really creative but not artistic, you know, really interesting people, bubbly people, and crazy, let's put it like that. So my mother, from a really young age, she would adopt and take kids from broken families. She started her way as a social worker, as a as a therapist. She would volunteer in asylums, she dealt a lot with mental health and with a lot of social issues. And she had the ability to reach a lot of, she had access to a lot of broken families. And she decided that because the system isn't working fast enough, sometimes those kids that are being beaten by their parents or are about to die because their parents molest them or hurt them that much, there is no time for bureaucracy. So she would take them, she would take the law into her own hands, and she would just grab them from danger and she would place them in our private home. So my private home became this sanctuary, this guerrilla sanctuary, you can call it, non-sponsored by the government or any organization. And it became too much. It became the amount of kids sometimes my house contained was too much for me to bear. I needed my mother for myself. I have one more biological sibling, and it's not a big house, although it's lovely and warm, but it's not a huge house. It's not like a mansion. And the amount of kids that were traumatized and came from horrific situations, it felt like there is a tsunami of horrors flooding my home, and I would suffocate there. I could not breathe next to all this grief and you know, the amount of violence these kids like suffered from. It's something that it's like another planet for normal people who never experienced those circumstances.
I can see the immediate attraction to the Band-Aid.
Maybe. So my trauma is coming from there. I felt like I'm losing my home physically and emotionally, losing my mother's attention. She was too busy, and she always thought that I'm very strong. I wasn't that strong to handle all that. And I drowned, basically. And that's what led me to create my poetry outdoors. I had to escape. The house was not a safe place for me mentally. And I had to get out. I had to tell someone. So I chose walls. And this was my way of screaming. And most of my poetry, since forever, they are very personal about my family, about my mental health situation. And it's like it's almost like an open diary.
It's interesting to say that like your poetry is very personal when it's, you know, it's hundreds or not hundreds, but dozens of meters in the air and seen from the main highway in Tel Aviv and Ayalon, and you can see your poetry there. Like that feels like the least personal place in the world.
I know. So imagine this is my way of screaming. I need it to be very big. I need everyone to see, because I really felt transparent. I felt betrayed, because it feels like in the beginning of my life, I was promised a different life for myself. You know, I was supposed to be this privileged little girl who gets all the attention. This is what I imagined. This is what I was born into. And I had this moment of being that privileged little girl until I was, I don't know, 3. And then it all started. So I always had this feeling of I was promised something else. I was promised the full attention of my parents. And it was taken away because the world is hell and people need help.
Mm. Let's talk about another world as hell and that complexity. Dede, you created probably one of the biggest pieces I've ever seen in the site of the Dolphinarium nightclub, which before it was a nightclub, it was actually an event hall. That was where my bar mitzvah was.
Wow.
Yeah, and then it became a nightclub, and famously or infamously, the place of a Hamas suicide bomber attack in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd expect that when someone comes and creates someone like you, graffiti, you'd expect like a huge band-aid there. Mm-hmm. But there you actually didn't do a band-aid. What was the art that you created there?
So, I mean, I have more theory and more paintings than only band-aids. I have more themes that I paint along the years. And maybe the one theory that I'm most proud of, the most challenging one, is the site-specific theory, and the Dolphinarium is one of them, if not the number one in the list, which is like conveying a message on a building with a specific architecture that supports the message, and also tell a story in its surroundings. So you have this list, and when all the stars are getting along in one line, it's like very, very powerful. So the Dolphinarium, I noticed this building about 3 years before I actually painted there, and I kept going there all the time. It was abandoned, the people broke inside, they made the, you know, campfire inside, homeless people slept there 4 years, then it was blocked, then it was breaking into again, and I kept going there. This place is unique also because of like the history, everything that you mentioned, but also because it's a very hot real estate point that separates between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, and there was one private real estate owner that wanted to build a huge tower there and block the view for like three neighborhoods that are just behind it, and it's like the front just next to the, like kissing the sea, you know, and there were many fights around this hot real estate. The municipality, the real estate itself, and the neighborhoods and lawyers that represent them for years, like maybe a decade. And I wanted to say something very specific in the place, but also I couldn't ignore the unique shape of the building. You can't just put a band-aid. I mean, you can't just put a band-aid there, but maybe you can do more with this very interesting building. And like I said, I kept going back there thinking what I can do. And I broke into the place myself and I sit inside, you know, there's the pool of the dolphins and the place of the club that you mentioned. And I was walking this all empty area when it was abandoned. And I didn't know what to do. But one day I went outside and I just sat on a rock in front of it and I looked, and I immediately knew what I have to paint there, because this shape of the wind-up teeth, this iconic toy of, again, American, very American toy, says it all. I mean, it's a bite of real estate in the city and on the expense of all the neighbors around, and the huge fight between so many people. Everyone just want this piece of land, territory. They fight about it. And there's something also about the mouth. You think about the mouth and about the teeth when you think about the bombing that was there. Is someone like, is the laughing about it? Is someone screaming because of it? I don't know, the many ideas. And and seeing this unique shape with the gap, I knew immediately I have to put the teeth there and it will be perfect. And then it took some time to actually reach the point that I can do it, because it's an illegal piece. It's huge. it's 11 meters in the air and you have to do it illegally and to walk from the ground. You can like just go on a ladder and paint there, and you need to find the right time when there is no wind, because you're holding a huge telescope pole attached to another pole and you have to reach with this small brush to the tip, and you have to do it at night. And, you know, it took me a long time to actually achieve that. It was very challenging, but it was worth it, of course.
You see why I fell in love with him?
Be careful. I'm falling in love with him.
All right.
And then how did you get to the U.S.? Because I can tell you, like, I have known about your work way before I've known you. You can see your work everywhere in Tel Aviv. For me, you are part of Tel Aviv. You're part of the scenery. You're part of, it's the same like Migdal Shalom. It's the same like Neve Tzedek. You're like, there are places where it's like, this is Tel Aviv and you are Tel Aviv. So how did you end up in New York City?
So we got accepted to a residency program, which for people who are not from our field, it means there are many programs for artists. Sometimes they give you studio space. Sometimes they give you budget. And they give you basically the opportunity to evolve and to meet new colleagues and new mentors and to grow in a new atmosphere. So we got accepted to a specific project, to this residency. And we were meant to be here only for 3 months and then to get back home. That's it. We did it so many times before. Almost every year we try to find residencies here in New York or in the US. And we would come every year to 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. And so this was, again, the same thing for us. Nothing out of the normal. But then after,
what happened?
Yeah, so we arrived on September 23, 1 month before the war broke. So 1 month before October 7th. And we were here. We were so far away from home in a place that, yeah, we know we've been here. We are not absolute strangers, but didn't feel like we have a community. We didn't know anyone. We had two friends, top. We felt so isolated. And as all Israelis and all Jews, we really felt and understood that Israel is not going to last. Not going to last even one night. And you can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't do anything. So basically, what's the point of creating art and getting back to the studio, to the program, when you know that your country is burning? What's the point in creating? There is no point. So we found ourselves here, really isolated. And we said to ourselves, okay, we better pack our stuff and get on the first airplane and join the IDF or volunteer, unless we find the best idea in the world of how to help the hostages from New York, which is the most important city in the world, and we can help them from far away in ways we could have never done in Israel. And we gave ourselves 24 hours of thinking. We told ourselves, if we're not going to find it in 24 hours, we're going to get the hell out of here. And we found an idea.
We brainstormed for some time and we searched ideas, and we knew we wanted to reach, you know, every passersby here in the streets of New York. And we need like a common ground. We need to talk with them visually in a way they will understand and react to.
What did you want to tell them?
So we wanted to talk about the hostages, about the urgency, about we need more people here to take action and help us with this situation. And of course, everything was terrible and awful and so many dead people, you know. But we wanted to talk about the hostages because they still had a chance. We want to bring them back. And we actually never thought it will last for that long. You know, we thought, okay, by the weekend, they will return. I mean, 240 people, babies, what? We couldn't imagine it will last for that long.
And still is, as yeah, we're recording.
Still going exactly. on as we speak. So we searched for an idea, and we came up with the milk cartons that were so iconic in the US in the 80s and the 90s. And it's something that everyone, even us, not American, have in the back of our mind from movies, from...
Pop culture.
And we started exploring that, and we made sketches and later on the poster based on the milk cartons. Of course, we changed the title. You know, it used to be Missing. We insist to put Kidnapped there because that's what happened. And we wanted to put some text talking about October 7 because it's very, very specific. We want people to know what happened. And it was so important for us to put the right photos.
Yeah,
put...
you remember that I phoned you?
I that's exactly what I was going to ask you.
We were talking that night.
On October 8th, so 24 hours, like you said, Jordan, my wife and I, we were sitting in our bathroom because one kid was sleeping in our bedroom, the other in their bedroom. So it was the only place we could sit. And you two were on speakerphone. And because Jordan is your translator, both of yours, and we're working on the text. What do you remember? Exactly. Do you remember that conversation?
Of course I do. I remember everything.
That night clearly.
We went to a friend of us, Kobe Krieger. He's one of our best friends here, and he's a very smart guy. And we told him, it has to be done right now. And he brought two friends. One is a lawyer, amazing. He was an amazing help for us. And one is a doctor, he's genius too. And we both sat down, and we've put you on the line in order to have the text of the first batch of posters correct. And it was like, I don't remember how many sentences, but it wasn't long,
one paragraph.
Like a paragraph. And each word had to be accurate and truthful and to the point. Because we knew that if we're going to put those posters in the street with the faces of the hostages, the text below, although it was very small text, it has to be 100% correct. So we consulted with you guys and we all approved the draft and off we went. And we finished that evening and Dede and I took off in the morning. We printed 2,000 copies, started hanging the posters in the street, crossing Manhattan and trying to interest different people in the streets for taking the poster.
Do you remember where you put your first poster?
Wow, the first one. We started Midtown, and I think, you know what? I think around Bryant Park. We started around Bryant Park.
No, I think before. We started in Ridgewood because we used to live in Ridgewood. So we started... We took the train from Ridgewood, so we probably put it next to our home. And then we took the L, and then we came to Manhattan. Yeah. So it's tricky. But we did a lot of them in the subways, and in the entrances, and then we climbed to the top.
Then we crossed next to the UN.
Yeah.
I remember, because I think it was October 9th, so really 2 days after the massacre, Jordan was in charge of the Upper East Side and I was in charge of the Upper West Side. And I remember putting all of them and it felt weird.
Yeah.
It felt weird to be putting posters of Israelis that are in Gaza in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
although some of them are Americans, some of them are Hindu, some of them are Thai, some of them are Muslim, some of them are Christians.
Yeah, that's also the contrast. I mean, we wanted people to think that maybe we're talking about their neighbor, and we wanted them to approach the poster and read and then discover it's someone.
Some of them were their neighbors.
Yeah.
Some of the people that were held hostage are New Yorkers, are people from Tenafly, are people from many other places. Yeah. They are their neighbors.
And then what happened? How did the posters from, you know, starting in Ridgewood and Midtown and Upper West Side and Upper East Side end up all over the world?
Because people were not interested. People we approached on the streets were not interested of hearing, listening, and seeing what we have to show them. So basically, Dede and I were very naive. We came from a very traumatized, burning place of urgency. But we could not understand that no one else is sharing the same emotions as us, and the world is just, you know, doing its usual. So people wanted nothing to do with us. It was a full day of crossing Manhattan and receiving only no's, like no after no. No one wanted to do anything with the two of us. And we felt like, we felt betrayed. We felt devastated. We felt like Israel is alone in the world. Way before Israel, you know, in the New York Times, they said, Israel is alone. I don't remember the exact newspaper, but there is like a title, mm-hmm. Israel is alone. We really felt that on the first day after October 7th. And that's why we chose to upload the files to Dropbox file and share it with as many Israeli WhatsApp groups possible, the ones that exist in New York. And then it spread like wildfire because we touched the right audience.
And the day after, we went outside and we saw thousands of posters all over the city that we never put up. And by the end of the next day, we got photos of posters from all over the world. The Far East, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, everywhere.
And in the next 6 months, we became organized. We had a group, like a headquarter of really dedicated volunteers who were responsible for so many aspects of this guerrilla campaign. Each had his own unique mission, and we operated as one, like machine almost. We dedicated 8 months just doing that. And it's a lot of work updating 33 different languages posters. Every day there are changes. Different family members of the hostages needs to add more of their family members or to remove or to change things that are done by mistake, like spelling mistakes in family names. So you need to update it in 33 different languages. So we had an amazing like volunteer doing only that. And we had a volunteer running the social media, and we had the design, and we had so many aspects, and the PR. We all did it as a group of people, dedicated people, who did it from their souls. And this is what kept us for 8 months just running on fumes in a place we did not belong in. Hmm.
What was the most meaningful place that you saw a poster or the poster reached?
So we had different surprises every day when the campaign started rolling. We couldn't imagine how many influencers and people we see only in movies will hold the poster on their social media. And we couldn't believe that every president, every important president, you know, will hold the poster Congress people, Senate.
People brought it to the UN.
The UN.
It was everywhere.
Then, you know, after like a month or 2 months, we see soldiers entering with the posters to Gaza and putting the posters on trees there. And these photos are shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And like searching for the kidnapped people there with our posters.
Also, some really, really crazy brave Israelis or Jews went to Arab countries and put the posters up. This is like really dangerous.
Yeah.
They did it in Turkey, they did it in Egypt, in places that do not welcome us at all and do not care about the hostages at all. And they were there. I don't know why, but they decided to put the posters.
But the story has another part. Do you remember the first time you saw a torn poster?
Yeah,
yeah, it was online, actually.
Online?
Before I saw it in real life, I saw it online. It was the famous, like, reel, like the video that ran on Instagram of the Muslim girl in
NYU?
England or something like that.
In London, yeah.
In London, maybe. And she's like really cursing and tearing down many posters. And that was in England.
What did you think? What went through your mind?
That it's just a radical Muslim tearing down posters in England. And then it will be okay.
Like there's extremists everywhere. It's one more extremist. Yeah. That's it.
We were very naive at first. But then it became like a huge wave. It started slowly, but suddenly it was a huge, huge wave. Of people tearing down posters, and you could really see it becoming a trend on social media, like any other trend, but it's like life of people.
And the longest trend ever.
Yeah.
Still is.
You've probably spent a lot of time thinking about this. Why are people still tearing down posters of the hostages?
Why are people still hating the Jews after thousands of years? Same. For me, it's very clear. It's very simple. You cannot justify it by saying, no, Israel is a post-colonial state who's doing this and doing that. No. People hated us, tried to kill us since forever, and it will stay like that. Nothing will change. The only thing that did change is our ability to thrive, to survive, to protect ourselves, and to have wonderful lives. That's it. That's our job, to protect ourselves, not to solve the problem of anti-Semitism. We need a strong army. We need to be strong no matter where we are. And that's the only way for us to be able to continue living. That's very basic. I don't think we can ever solve the anti-Semitism problem. It's rooted, it's ancient, and it's profoundly engraved in people's heritage, almost to their DNA. It's something that we cannot change. Why fight it when you can take your energy and build better shields and better systems for yourself? And then your core can really thrive, because we Israelis and Jews can thrive like that. Just give us one moment of like prosperity and boom, here we go. We grow so fast. Like we thrive like no one else did before. So I look at the world and I say, it's exactly what my grandfather warned me about. It's exactly what, and my family has documentations like 1,000 years ago. So I know exactly what pogroms in Russia, my grand, experienced. And he saw his girl and wife being slaughtered in front of his eyes. I'm talking about almost 700 years ago. He wrote it in his diary and we kept it. So this is life. you have to be better. You have to protect yourself.
But a lot of the people that were tearing them, at least on the outside, seemed normative people.
But you know, the Nazis were normal people. Don't you think? They were normal. Everyone on this planet are normal. Everything is normal. We are not aliens. Nazis are not aliens that came from another planet. And they look like you. They like the same food as you. They make love with their wives. They give birth. They love their kids. Sometimes they don't like their kids. They're just like us. But then, as a side gig, they hate you. So they're normal.
So what was your solution to seeing all the torn posters?
So I think at first everyone, not only us, but you know, all the groups, everyone that used to put up posters decided to go even more extreme, to put more posters, to put it more addictively everywhere. Other people reached out and they wanted to put the hostages' faces in places that you can't tear down. Newspaper, billboards, digital TVs on like trucks that going driving in the city, projections on different buildings like the UN or museums around the world.
It actually helped us.
It helped a lot. Many people, you know, they could invest in billboard, buy a projector, rent a projector or pay for a digital TV. And they did it. And we helped with graphics, but we did never ask for anything else. And we continue to roll this project. And actually, tearing down the posters gave us so much PR attention, because in the beginning, you know, we got much media coverage. Like everyone reached out to hear about the posters, but then after
2 months, they forgot about it.
Yeah, they just, you know, how much can you talk about the poster? And then after people started tearing them down, the interest grew and grew, and even more media outlets reached out to hear more about the story. And every time we went to give an interview, we brought up the hostages and we tried to avoid politics and talk only about them and bring them again to the center and keep this project, you know, growing and rolling.
Keep their names alive, keep their faces alive, so anyone on this planet can know their story and remember them. And yeah, it was important.
Almost ironically, I don't even know if that's what you were planning, but it became symbolic of something like the early graffiti wars, like a tag war.
Yeah.
It was neighborhoods where there are posters and neighborhoods where there are no posters. And for a Jew walking around in New York or traveling in Europe, you knew where there are more Jews or less Jews or more supporters and less supporters based on the posters.
Yeah, definitely. After as month passed, you could see neighborhoods that are still filled with posters or half filled with posters, and other neighborhoods that are empty completely. And this time it's not necessarily because of the weather, sun, rain, snow, you know, just people were tearing them down. So you could really feel in what neighborhood you feel safer or not. You could recognize the audience. It's also, you know, we both, as we started talking, coming from the street art and graffiti scene, we used to our artwork in the street, not surviving sometimes very long. Sometimes we create in the street and the artwork disappeared the day after, if not maybe a year after, but it's temporary. Here in this project, you know, we're talking humanitarian project. It's about life of people. We want to rescue them. For us, maybe we're kind of naive, but we We couldn't understand people that don't want to join. And of course, we couldn't understand people that tear down the poster. It was crazy.
I can understand them. I know their motives, but I don't agree with them. No, I get them. I get them. I really do. And if it was the opposite, I would have taken their side. It's very easy, but I understand them and their motives, but I'm on the other side of the coin. I am who I am. I was born like that. And we actually, by mistake, we taught the Jewish people how to do graffiti.
Yeah.
And how to fight with graffiti.
But this time, you know, this project, the posters stay the same, right? For a long time. But the situation around it changed all the time. So the meaning and what people think about the posters and how they look at the posters changed. In the beginning, we got this period of time where people didn't tear down posters because they felt, you know, they felt for what's going on there, or at least they respected in a way.
How long did it last? Maybe 10 days.
Not long, okay. But the situation changed and the poster like stood in place. And it's every time, every day, you got more surprises, more meanings. And you could see by the peak of the news, the media coming from Israel, you could see the reaction in the street through the posters live the same day.
When you could actually see the brainwashing machine
when
working.
When there was a big story about the bombing in the morning in the news, in the same day, many, many posters were teared down. And in other days, slower.
As if the hostages are to blame.
Yeah,
because
after some time, people didn't see the faces anymore on the posters. They saw the posters as a symbol for Israel and for the Israeli war. And they don't see the person in the poster anymore.
Let's be honest. Most of the people that tore down the posters did not see the faces as humans to begin with. Because let's give an example. 10 days... On average, it took the majority of people to start tearing down the posters. Israel did not attack yet. So nothing happened. Only the hostages were in Gaza. I mean, that was the status quo. Hostages in Gaza. And Israel did not attack at that point. And yet people started really massively tearing down the posters.
There's a wide, very wide spectrum. I mean, some people are against us. No matter what.
Exactly.
But, you know.
When did you decide to slow down or stop?
After 8 months.
What happened?
We had a rough time here. So obviously we dropped from the residency program. So that wasn't relevant for us. It's so weird. A lot of weird things happened to us. People broke into our apartment in Ridgewood, the one that we started everything from. We got so many death threats and so many people harassed us. So many DMs on WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, phone calls. Not only us, also the members from our group. Especially the ones that lived in America, they were also deeply harassed.
Harassed just because you were putting the posters for the hostages?
Because we were the group responsible for it. And Dede and me were on the news all the time, and we were the face of this guerrilla campaign. So we were an easy target. So after our apartment was... I mean, the window was shattered and people, I don't know, went through stuff there. We met this unique individual. I don't know how your listeners are going to react, but that's the truth. So I'll just tell it as it is. He's a medium, okay? Uh-huh. I see your face.
Yes.
Right? I see your face.
Forget my audience. You know how I will react.
Exactly. So your audience is in good hands, okay? You represent probably 99% of your audience. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a, like a super spiritual. I am spiritual, not in that way. But be open with us, okay? Bear with us. We met him. We never met him before. He is a medium for celebrities. And we met him for dinner. Some great, amazing individuals, Jewish people, wanted to help us because they felt like we are really drowning here. We're two foreigners in a big city. We didn't have anything. So then he came spontaneously because he's a friend of one of them. And the moment he sat down among his friends, he looked at Dada and me, and he said, it touched his friends, and he said, okay, stop talking about whatever it is you're talking. They need help because their lives are in great danger. And then he started describing the alley to our apartment and the amount of stairs and the way the windows built. And it was
the door, how the door looks like, the opening. The
and
room.
The opening and the way
I would
the
say you have a you have someone, a stalker, not a medium. But.
Shy. Okay.
No, but it's okay. It's
unexplainable because none of these people knew us very well. They never came to visit our apartment. No one visited our apartment. We never shared any stories on our social media showing anything from this apartment. We were very careful. So he described things to the tiniest detail, and he said, people are going to try to open or smash that window and grab you out of there, and you need to pack your belongings now. It was night time. It was dinner time. And get the hell out of there. And never return to this apartment. It's dangerous for you. And you know what? Whether he's right or wrong, whatever he saw there, we felt it anyway.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. But it was like a warning sign for us that, okay, we do not belong there anymore. We have to move from Ridgewood, from this weird porter apartment, which was not safe for us at that time. And he held the hand of his friend who was sitting next to him, and he told her, you need to give them a place to stay, and it has to have a doorman and security cameras. That's the rule. And if you're going to move from place to place, this is the rule. Security cameras and a doorman. You need to be safe. And then we started moving. We moved 7 different apartments. The harassment never stopped. We were very fragile walking in the streets. We were almost acting as two paranoids. But we never stopped giving interviews. We never stopped hanging the posters. And we never stopped talking about the hostages. After 8 months, we were very tired. We were not earning money. We were exhausted. We were burning our savings. New York is expensive. Just to eat outside, it's like a lot of money. So we were very, very out of breath at that point. And it's not that we stopped, but, you know, the thing that made us tired the most is after the first ceasefire, the first deal, they brought a lot of hostages, but then half of them remained in Gaza. Then it was quiet again. And we just didn't have the energy to start all over again, like properly.
Yeah.
So a mixture of all this is why we slowed down.
Do you ever stop and think about what you did? Like how big and important and impactful that 24 hours of like, let's find something to do, what it actually achieved?
No.
I mean, we don't feel like it's over, of course. It's not finished, and we can't feel like we accomplished what we wanted. Of course, we made all this project, like everything going, so many stuff happened. People, of course, everyone knows the faces, and people, and we reached decision makers, which was the main first goal. But it's not over. We are still stuck. We can't look, reflect back on this project and say we made it. It's not, we can't.
Until we all become. Yeah.
And we still continue. We are not putting the posters. Yeah. We do it. There is a film that is based on our efforts and about this campaign. And we are part of the film. It's a phenomenal film called Torn, who is describing the act of tearing down the poster and the fight between the pro-Palestinians and the pro-Israelis in the streets of Manhattan. This is what the film about. And we go with this film. It's a full film, like a feature. We travel all over the country with this film and the director and some of the participants. And we give talks and we give Q&As. And Dede and I talk a lot about the hostages. Every week we have an event. We speak. We give art talks. We give talks about artivism and about this campaign. And we encourage the new generations to create their own campaigns, and we teach them based on our experiences, because we want the next generation to be able to create new things for our people. And we need to pass down the torch.
And most importantly, for them to understand that they can make a difference, they mm-hmm. can act, they can... It's up to us, it's up to everyone. So you can't wait for someone.
We didn't stop talking about the hostages. We're just doing it in a different way.
Do you remember what you told me in, I think it was October 2023? You were over for dinner, maybe it was Shabbat. And just before you left, we were sitting on our stoop. And we were talking about activism. Mm-hmm. And Yunitsan said, you need to think in the mindset of, even if I need to clean the streets for a living, I don't care because this is important.
I still agree. I still agree with myself. Oh no!
But you should be willing to lose everything because this is the right thing.
Because it's our people.
Yeah,
I remember. What else do we have in this world?
So, what are you working on now? What's next for two of you?
So for this 8 months, since we started, since October, we didn't have a studio, and we were in the city. We couldn't go and create anyway. Nothing felt important enough, to actually make art. I mean, the posters doesn't look like anything we do usually. Of course, people look and say they are artists and this is an art project, but for us, it was an act of need. It was activism. It had to be there, but we didn't look at it as art. And we didn't have a studio. And for us, after over a decade of going to the studio every day and create, and this was our life, to go and create and communicate and suddenly we don't have it for almost a year.
And so basically three miraculous things happened. A lot of miraculous things happened. Even the medium was pretty incredible and life-changing for us. So the first thing that happened, a phenomenal Jewish woman helped us find an apartment. So there we had our home, our nest, a place to... No, we stopped moving every week from place to place. We had a ground. We had our own bed. So this is one miracle. And the second miracle is Silverstein Properties gave us a studio space in the World Trade Center. It's just above Ground Zero. We observe the American trauma from our window. And we think about home and we think about 20 years from now. How will we look like? How will we react? How will we thrive after and heal from our trauma? So for us, it's really emotional having a studio space up there. And the view is amazing. And it's like a gift from God almost. It's not almost, it's a gift from God, period. Everything we received is a gift from God. The third thing we had as a gift from above is an opportunity to create in an art program. Again, a different art program. This time, 8 months after the war broke, after we became very exhausted, an opportunity knocked on our door, and amazing collector selected us to come to Martha's Vineyard, which is like heaven. And we felt like we are coming from like a hellish situation in Manhattan, because hell is now in kibbutzim, in Gaza, in Israel. So now we found ourselves for 3 weeks in Martha's Vineyard, and it's the most beautiful place on earth, maybe. I don't know.
It was the first time we were leaving the city after everything that happened.
Yeah.
And the first time we forced to have a break with this project that we're so locked into. And we find ourselves in this magical place. Mm-hmm. And still, you know, we arrive, we sit there, we look around, we're staying in this beautiful farm. And we feel like we are in a kibbutz. We feel the kibbutzim, because we have all this charge in our mind, and we try to unwind, but you know, we see around us club cars, we see around us white pickup truck.
Like Hamas used to drag the hostages.
We see nice people that don't know you, but they pass by on their bike and they say hello, like a kibbutz. And everything feels like a kibbutz. Mm. And
you know, it's legal there to hunt deers in hunting season, apparently. So when you walk in the forest, you just see skeletons all over the place. And you feel like you're in the fields looking at death. Although it's something else, but still it's like there laying on the ground. And then slaughter day comes. Slaughter day in the chicken coop, because they grow their own chickens. And at some point they want to eat them. So they need to slaughter them. They don't have machines. It's not an industry. It's the farmer with the knife. So it's slaughter day. And the entire floor is covered with blood. And the white pickup trucks are filled with blood splatter. It's very triggering for us. So everything there was triggering.
Everywhere we looked, we found triggers. And in this beautiful environment, like a magical island, we see triggers. And we go there, we walk there for 3 weeks.
And we documented it.
And we documented it. We had to take photos and then started painting them.
And so, that's your new art that I've seen you work on. Trauma, you can't run away from trauma.
Exactly.
It runs after you.
Mm.
Even in the most beautiful places.
Well, typically I tell people that I wish we could keep the conversation going and I'll have him for another episode, but I know you'll come to my Shabbat dinner. I don't know if tonight or next week, but we'll keep the conversation going.
We love your food very much. Yeah. I mean, your wife.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to end the episode with what I call the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answers. That's the first thing that comes to mind. You know, and you can jump. I think people will recognize your voices. Nitzan Mintz, Tele Band-Aid, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Wow.
Well, for you, Tele, it's easy. They don't know who you are.
I hope so.
That he's very pretty. Yeah. He's handsome.
He's a great looking man.
I try.
He's a nice, don't exaggerate.
What about you, Nitzan?
Tele, you answer. Okay, let's play another game. Daddy will answer on my behalf, and I'll answer on his behalf, okay?
It's the last time I'm having Israelis on the show.
They make decisions on their own. Okay, Dil, you answer on my behalf. I answer on your behalf.
They don't know that you like hummus?
Who cares?
Okay.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Wow, I thought about a very dirty thing. I don't know if I'm allowed to say.
Go ahead.
Big.
I have to say, we've heard that once before in the show, and it was from another artist, Zoe Buckman.
So apparently,
there's something in artists, but okay.
Apparently.
Okay. Big hearts.
Big hearts. Yeah.
What is your favorite curse?
My favorite curse is not.
That is Nevela.
Nevela?
Yes, yeah. Nevela.
Carcass. Carcass, yeah.
Nevela.
Yeah, it's true.
How about you?
I say it a lot. Wow.
Mine? What's mine?
Probably Emek.
Emek, without the kus.
Emek. When was the last time you cried?
Dede never cried.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Maybe when he was born. Maybe not.
But it's on once a week?
Yeah, once a period, you know.
Mm-hmm. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Dona Grazia. I didn't answer on your behalf. Who's yours?
Answer in my behalf.
I don't know. You want to...
I want to have Mike Myers. Does it count?
Yeah. Mike Myers is Jew.
Yeah, Mike Myers and Dona Grazia.
Yeah.
He's a genius.
He's a genius, okay. Yeah.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Shavuot.
Yeah, I would say.
When do you feel safest?
In Tel Aviv.
So true.
Yeah.
When do you feel least safe?
Ridgewood.
But we should be clear, Ridgewood, New York, and not Ridgewood,
Queens,
New Jersey.
Yeah, exactly.
What gives you hope?
Maybe corny, I don't know, but reflecting the past year and a half, filling our community here gives me
community.
Super hope. Yeah.
Community is basically everything.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity if it does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Aviv Sherwood is saving
wildlife animals. Yeah.
One time, Dede and I saved a pigeon. You know, a pigeon, but we saved it.
It landed on our roof.
Yeah, it landed on our roof. And then we took it. No one from the municipality agreed to take this pigeon because no one cares about pigeons. And the only person who took the pigeon and helped it with infusions, you know, he took really good care of it.
X-rays, everything.
X-rays. It was Aviv Sherwood in Israel. He's helping any wildlife you can imagine.
Where can people find him? How can people donate to
Facebook.
Aviv Sherwood
Wildlife, yeah.
They have a YouTube, Facebook, everything.
He's a genius. He's an amazing person.
All right. Nitzan, Dede, where can people find you?
Instagram, Facebook.
What's your Instagram?
Facebook.
My name, Nitzan means... Nitzan Mintz.
Nitzan.
Yes.
Mintz.
It's annoying, but yes.
And Dede Ben-David in one word attached. It's on Instagram, Facebook, my website, all the same.
Dede Ben-David.
Ben-David.
Where can people find, see, and buy your art?
They need to contact us because thank God the building that our studio is located in has the highest security maybe on the country.
Mm-hmm.
After 9/11, this area is very well protected. And for us, it worked very well because of what we've been dealing with.
And maybe we should plug one last thing before we end. The Dede's annual...
Afikoman hunt.
Yeah.
We made it for the first
Explain
time.
What is the Afikoman for people?
And... So the Afikoman, of course, it's in Pesach, our favorite holiday. And the half of matzah that the young kids have to search around the house and find it and get the prize. And for about 10 years, I'm having the Afikoman treasure hunt in the city, in the streets of Tel Aviv. I'm hiding art afikoman, which are original pieces that I hide, and I put clues on social media. People run, and it's growing every year. There are more and more people searching for the Fickle Man and trying to be the first to grab it.
And this time, this year, we did it in New York.
We had it in New York for the first time, which was...
We participated. And unfortunately, me and my kids, we couldn't find any.
It was so good.
But it was great. And it's for a lot of people, it's fun to do with the kids, or if you don't have kids, to do by yourself. And if you find one of the Fickle Mans, you have an original piece of art.
So next Pesach, we're going to do it again.
We'll do it again.
All right. Well, this was so much fun. It took us, we spent a lot of time on this episode because I didn't want to stop any piece of your love and empathy and insight and brilliance. And I'm just happy to say, here I am with Nitzan Mintz and Deda Ben-David.
Thank you so much. We love you very much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."